Lake Geneva. Humidity stands at 81%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, hoping you and yours had a safe and happy 4th of July. We're turning our gaze backward to the mid-1960s and to a moment in our history that is often very much misunderstood, and a term that's often misunderstood as well, hippie. The book at hand is called Hippie Incorporated, the misunderstood subculture that changed the way we live and generated billions of dollars in the process. The author of this book, Michael Claussen, is actually on the faculty of the School of Business at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, Iowa. And Professor Claussen is not a historian. He is really more of an economist and an expert in marketing. So he's coming at this topic from a very intriguing perspective, looking at a generation or a portion of a generation that we tend to think of in really simplistic terms, and we vastly misunderstand, particularly the earliest hippies from a narrow range of time, 1965 to 1967, leading up to the famous Summer of Love, and really misunderstand and fail to appreciate all of the ways in which they created innovative products, many of which are with us to this very day. So Professor Claussen is mining a really fertile ground here in the study that he has done over the course of many, many years, and then ultimately the publication of this book. Again, it's titled Hippie Incorporated, the misunderstood subculture that changed the way we live and generated billions of dollars in the process, published by 6on7 Books. Professor Michael Claussen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a privilege to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation about your fascinating book and its intriguing premise. First of all, you are someone who does not neatly align with this period of time. I mean, I think some people who maybe write books about this are in a sense writing about their own personal history. Your own personal history, I don't think, really quite aligns with this earliest hippie movement. Just say a word about your own personal relationship with this movement, this culture, and the writing of this book.
Sure. I was born in 1954, so I'm actually the same age as Steve Jobs, which sometimes puts it in perspective. Steve Jobs and myself both would have been too young. You know, I went to Haight-Ashbury when I was 14, but as a tourist.
And we should mention that's the famous neighborhood in San Francisco where this particular chapter of the hippie movement was born.
That's correct, yeah. And I'm old enough to have been issued my draft number as well for the Vietnam War. And, you know, I had a proud family history of fighting, and I was prepared to go as a 16, 17-year-old. But then I went to college, and I realized this was a different situation than I wanted to get into. So I was affected by the hippie movement at different levels. But you're right, I was too young to be a part of the community, even though there were some people who were that young. Most of the people, Greg, which you were talking earlier about the misconception, most of the people in the very earliest community in the Haight District or the Haight-Ashbury District were not boomers. They were older than that. And so that's something, first of all, that needs to be stated. You know, we had in that group of people and in that leadership, primarily people who were in their later 20s and early 30s in that group. And four of them, Greg, were actually born in Nazi camps or have survived Nazi camps. And several of them were highly decorated soldiers, not of the Vietnam War, but of the Korean War. So it's a very different conception than what we have of kind of the self-indulgent baby boomers, you know, doing this love, sex, and rock and roll.
Right.
Yeah, very different.
In fact, it probably would be helpful before we start focusing on the sort of the heart and soul of your book to kind of sketch that framework of history that I think will really help our listeners and me, for that matter, kind of frame this conversation. We've already mentioned that your book focuses on what you consider to be the dawn of the hippie movement. But, of course, ahead of that, we had something else that is sometimes confused with it, the beatniks. And then later hippies and campus radicals who also are part of kind of this overarching history that we tend to all think of with sort of a big wash. Just clarify that historical framework, if you will, and then we'll focus in on what was the focus of your book.
Be happy to. It is those are groups that are often confused. Between about the years of 1952 and 1960, we had a group of primarily young people in the North Beach district of San Francisco that the media dubbed beatniks, but who referred to themselves often as beats. The beatnik or beat movement, Greg, was primarily an artistic and literary movement. And it was somewhat like the hippie movement, but it was also very different. Between the years of about 60 and 65, some people call those the dead years because not a great deal was going on in terms of the rebellion or in terms of that counterculture in San Francisco, or at least that's the common thought. As a matter of fact, there was still a lot of things going on, but it wasn't very very high profile by any means. But in that very earliest group, we have people such as Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, Michael McClure, and other very talented artists and authors. During 60 to 65, I call that period in my book the Neo-Beat period. This is the period of time where the beatnik movement has basically gone away, or is it slowly going away, and the hippie movement is yet to arrive. And those neo-beats were very, very important in what was to come next, which, of course, was the hippie movement. I began the hippie movement actually pretty specifically on the evening of November 27, 1965, and I end the hippie movement on the afternoon of October 6, 1967. So, Greg, what we have here is a period of time of less than 2 years, fewer than 100 weeks, and all within a simple, or rather a single, relatively small neighborhood, 28 blocks, that today we call the Haight-Ashbury. Once the movement ended on October 6, then it took on an entirely new form. This was the weeks following, as you mentioned earlier, the Summer of Love in 1967, when the district was invaded by tens of thousands of youth from around the nation. This was the boomer invasion. And once that happened, the neighborhood deteriorated very, very rapidly due to a number of things. But it did not end in terms of the spirit of the movement. The original movement was done. In fact, it's kind of ironic, Greg, that when most Americans first heard about the hippies, that movement was over with. I talked with Jay Thelen, who was, I call him hippie number two, and he remembers very clearly people coming into the Haight on the summer of 67 asking for this and for that. He says, "Oh, you're too late. That happened 9 months ago."
So
it was over with. And then, of course, the next iteration, I'll just finish real quickly, was the campus radical movement. And those three movements were very distinct, very different, and often at odds, at times at odds with each other.
We're speaking with Michael Klassen about his book, Hippie Incorporated, or Hippie Inc., The Misunderstood Subculture That Changed the Way We Live and Generated Billions of Dollars in the Process. It is a very careful examination of a fairly narrow range of time between November of 1965 and October of 1967, the origination of the hippie movement in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood of San Francisco. And his focus primarily is on the extraordinary amount of innovation and entrepreneurship that occurred with those earliest hippies. Professor Klassen, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear the story of what prompted you to begin studying this and approaching this. I know that it had something to do with your visit with your son about to go off to college in Santa Barbara, your visit to something called the Peace Store, which turned out to be a real big surprise for you, and in many respects the catalyst for years of research that followed thereafter. Tell us about your visit to the Peace Store.
I will. You know, we used to live in California in the 70s, but I'd never gotten to the town of Santa Barbara. And my son, our second son, wanted to go to college there. So we decided to explore it, and we were in Santa Barbara. And you probably know, Greg, that Santa Barbara is a fairly wealthy community. It has residents like Oprah Winfrey and many other people. We were walking down State Street in Santa Barbara, and it struck me as a business professor that this was a very high-end retail district. You know, we were seeing Tiffany's and various things like that. And then we ran across a store, as you said, called the Peace Store. And my thought was, what is a hippie store doing in this district? You know, you think of kind of the bong shops, the head shops that oftentimes are on the fringe of the retail. In this town, a lot of them are near the beach. So here was this big, beautiful store, and I walked in. It turned out, of course, it was nothing at all like a head shop. It was rather a kind of a European-style, two-floor high-ceiling boutique of clothing and different types of paraphernalia that were basically organized around hippie-like things, like John Lennon sayings and various things like that. And my thought was, after I walked out of there, what was the commercial impact of the hippie movement? It didn't dawn on me that we were just about to move into the 50th year. We're going to be celebrating the 50th year of the hippie movement here, really basically 2016 and 2017. This was back in 2007. So what I did is I just began to approach that topic like any business professor would, looking at data. And the first 2 years, I actually didn't talk to anybody. I just went into the literature, and I decided I would read nothing that was older than 1968. And so that's how I began. And then I
In other words, you really wanted to focus on accounts from the moment, not from people looking back.
Right. Yeah, I felt as I got into it, and I kind of felt this anyway, that the literature was just overweighted with memoirs and, you know, who was, you know, Mick Jagger having sex with. You know, it's just that kind of scandalous stuff. And I just didn't feel that it helped much to understand it. Certainly there was that element, but there was far, far more to it. And so I took a very scholarly approach, and I, you know, I'm happy to say, even though it sounds kind of tragic, that I spent the better part of my fifth decade on this planet studying hippies. I think I was 52 when I started, and I was 61 when it ended. So it was a 9-year investigation into it. You know, you're looking into FDA data. We're looking into all kinds of accounts and newspapers from that period of time. and just trying to stay away from anything that was kind of a recollection recently of what people had experienced. But look at the material that was all of the material I looked at was published before 68. And so that was, I was just taking a very scholarly view. About 2 years into this kind of, you know, academic study, I went to the Haight-Ashbury district, which today is very different than it was then, but still, you know, some semblance of it. And what I wanted to do was find the original 20 businesses. The businesses started on the day January 3, 1966. That was the very first hippie shop on Haight Street. It was called the Psychedelic Shop. It was started by Jay and Ron Thelen, who were both veterans, soldiers, who were now just trying to make their way into the world. And that shop, the Psychedelic Shop, became the epicenter of the original hippie movement. That is where tickets were bought and sold, information was exchanged, and it was a great pleasure, Greg, to spend several days with Jay Thelen in his home with his wife, Carol, and then we've also spent a great deal of time since that time. Unfortunately, Ron passed away in 1997. So that's what that was about. It was just a simple question. What was the commercial impact of the original Haight-Ashbury hippie movement? And that's what has led to this situation.
So you begin with firsthand accounts from the time, and rather than just reading recollections and so on. But, of course, right. Ultimately, your studies took you to, first of all, the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood itself, and then ultimately to some of these major players, most of them, I suppose, in their 70s by the time you were talking to them.
And
finding out from them their perspective on what occurred then. Talk for a moment about those encounters. And let's start with maybe the most mundane matter of all, but I bet it's a complicated matter. How did you track down these people, the many people that you talked to in your book, and how complicated a challenge was that?
Well, it took, you know, it took the better part of 9 years, Greg, you know, to get this done. And it was dozens of interviews. But what I have to say, much to their credit, I told my wife the other day, I said, we had only two bad interviews in 9 years, and I think that's pretty darn good. Everybody who I talked with were just gracious, very honest people. A lot of them felt they were, had been misunderstood. I remember my very first interview, I walked into a shop, and this fellow was still operating on Haight Street. It was in the lower Haight, which is not where the activity of the movement was. That was up in upper Haight, but he was in the lower Haight. And I remember in the first few minutes, he said, look, Mike, none of us are spring chickens anymore. And he said, if somebody doesn't get this story right, nobody ever will. And it was at that moment I said, okay, this is it. I'm getting my nose out of the books, and we're going to start talking to people. And this individual really was able to connect me with a lot of good folks. And these are all the original shakers and movers. Most of them, Americans have never heard their name. There's a few. Janis Joplin, obviously, we've heard her name, and Jerry Garcia. But there are so many more that just are completely unknowns in this early group. So it was basically just the old-fashioned way of reporting, Greg. You contact someone, and they turn you on to the next person, and away you go.
I'm curious about the concern that you raised in terms of how you went about studying this, that you at the outset were making a point of kind of avoiding that whole notion of reading dusty memoirs of people looking back fondly over something that occurred decades earlier. And but ultimately, of course, you find yourself in a sense then in that very same place, albeit talking to these people directly.
That's right.
But it's a very different exploration of the same thing. I wonder, first of all, what you thought about as you approached these people and sat down to talk with them in terms of trying to elicit from them the most helpful and the most honest answers to your questions about that time. I think I'm What prompts the question is just the understandable inclination that many people have to look at the distant past through rose-colored glasses or to build the ordinary events up into kind of mythical proportions or whatever.
Right,
I mean, people are people. So how did you go about making these encounters just as meaningful and helpful as possible?
Mm-hmm. Well, for one thing, I made sure that I had time with people. They, as I said, very gracious. I ended up spending a couple of days or spending the night with folks. If it took another day, I would just stay on and we would do it. We filmed it, and there is a film being made now, a movie being made. But we filmed it. We audiotaped it. I had notepads, and we were just, you know, listening carefully to what they had to say. And, of course, they are remembering those things. And I'll tell you, I had a really great appreciation for the historian after this. As you said earlier, I'm not a trained historian. But what I did is what I could do best, and that is to counter-check everything. So, in other words, if an individual said this is, you know, A happened, this is, I was there when it happened, then I would try to find documentation that verified that. And if I could connect at least two dots, that was pretty good. If I connect three, then it was, you know, that was pretty sure verification that in fact did happen. So that was kind of the methodology of the thing, if you will. Hmm. But these people were very open and very gracious, and they spoke freely about that. And I think a lot of them felt that, you know, it was time. As you said, most of them were in their 70s, and some were, in fact, in their 80s. Hmm. Some were ailing. Some passed away during the time that I was with them. There really was nothing left to hold back, Greg, you know, at this point in their lives. They said it as best they could and as clearly as they could. And sadly, for many of these, this will be their last interview.
Wow. So I think some people will be kind of curious about the fact that you delineate this period in our history as clearly as you do, as beginning on a specific date, November 27th, 1965, and it ends on October 6th, 1967. Explain that strict, specific time frame.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, to set a beginning and end date is always arbitrary with these things, as you know, Greg, because there's so much going on. But what happened on the night of November 27, 1965, I believe, was seminal. There was an event, and this was the first so-called acid test event that was held by Ken Kesey, of course, a renowned author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, among other things. He held this in an old abandoned dairy barn, actually, in rural San Francisco. Not in the district, because the district really stood for nothing at that point. That night, there was a band that played. They called themselves the Warlocks, probably a name most of your listeners have never heard of. But that was a Saturday night, and by Thursday, the Warlocks had changed their name to the Grateful Dead, who I think almost everybody in your audience has heard. On that single night, we had the first real gathering, a psychedelic gathering, if you will, of bohemians in the San Francisco area being entertained by the seminal hippie band, the Grateful Dead, would become. And before the night was over, several great innovations came out of that evening. So, and also what we find on November 27, what happened in the days following, along with the change to the Grateful Dead, was this incredible energy. The month of December was just an amazing month. It was almost like night after night after night, things were going on. And then we change over to the year 1966, and what happens on January 3, Ron and Jay Thelen opened the very first store, the first of many on Hay Street called the Psychedelic Shop. And that day, Ron, that was the kickoff. Over the next 16 months, I estimate that one shop per week was open, brand new shop on the Hay Street from there on out. That's incredible development, economic development. And this is a small neighborhood. This could be a small Wisconsin or Iowa town, 28 blocks. Can you imagine a shop opening every week? And this was a district or a neighborhood that up to that time was a pretty, you know, just typical hardware store, liquor store, laundromat. There was nothing unusual about the Haight District. And so why it is there, why I choose it, is because of that very seminal event on November 27th and then the incredible explosion of activities that happened afterwards. Now, in terms of the end of the movement, that was determined by the hippies themselves. And a lot of times people blow that off. They did the march of the hippie, the death march of the hippie on October 6, 1967 in the Panhandle. I was just there a couple of days ago. I could almost envision them walking down the Panhandle. They carried a casket. You know, it's all on YouTube. You can see these things. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, that was contrived. But it really wasn't, in my opinion, because the Summer of Love had just ended, and it was a mess. You know, I was in San Francisco talking with the California Historical Society on Monday, and they are going to put together events for the Summer of Love of 1967. And I told them, frankly, I said, that was not a good summer in some ways. It was a summer of deterioration, well, first of all, it rained a lot. It was a mess, and so on and so forth. But prior to that time, most of the original people were starting to get out. They saw it falling apart. They had talked with the powers that be, the government officials, the police, and said, look, this is not going to be good. They're going to tear this place apart, and we want to work with you. They did not get the cooperation that they wanted. They did take it on themselves, but it got away from them. And after that event was over, of course, the neighborhood was then flooded with people. And on October 6th, they said, that's it. This movement is over. And you know what? A lot of the originals left, and some of them never came back.
By the way, we're throwing around this neighborhood name of Haight Ashbury, which, of course, is well known to people who know something about the hippie movement and its early history. Can you explain why this happened to be the epicenter of the emergence of this hippie movement? Was there something in particular about this neighborhood, this intersection of these two streets, that made it fertile ground?
Yeah. You know, in the interviews, it became clear that the biggest reason it took place here was economic. So here a business professor picks up his ears again to try to hear what's going on. The Beatnik movement, which preceded it, was in what today we call Little Italy, beautiful little area of San Francisco, wonderful Italian food. But at the time, it was called North Beach. And North Beach had this kind of reputation in the original days, back gold days, the gold discovery days. It was called Barbary Coast. So that gives you some idea. It was a pretty pretty interesting area. And what was happening is, as the beats were kind of becoming more popular and various economic forces, is that rent just became outrageous in North Beach. And so the bohemian types of people moved on, and just other people. You know, a lot of folks came to the Haight District in 1965 for one basic reason, that was cheap rent. And in fact, you saw that time and time again. Why did they go to North Beach? Because of the cheap rent. Why did they go to the Haight? Because of the cheap rent. So it's a very, very practical economic reason why these things are happening. And of course, today the rent in Haight is not cheap, but at the time it was, and that was a primary motivator. I found that over and over again. I remember I was speaking with Janis Joplin, one of her managers, and I said, well, what provoked, he was 19 when he met Janis in the park walking her dog, and I said, what provoked you to go to Haight? He said, that's simple, it was cheap rent. Cheapest place in town. And what they would do is get these massive Victorian homes that may have 8, 9, 10 bedrooms in them. And then they would just share the rent. 25 people would live in that home. And in many ways, it's, you know, I could see the same thing. It does happen to this day with college students and with young people. That's still going on. So it wasn't some grand plan. Now, the other side of this was, of course, San Francisco State University is right down the block from Haight District. And, you know, San Francisco State has always had its, you know, its cutting edge of professors and writers and so forth. So there was also that influence. But you raise a good point. I mean, not only the hate, but San Francisco itself is just, there's a lot of key characteristics about the city that made it happen there, as opposed to, you know, Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Right.
Or Anchorage, Alaska, yeah.
And I don't remember if it's in your book or someplace else I read that the names of Haight and Ashbury are venerable names in the much earlier history of San Francisco.
Yeah.
I think one of those names is actually the last name of a famous maybe banker or something like
right.
that.
Yes, very conservative banker. And I can't recall his first name, but his last name was Haight. And the district was named after him. So that was totally coincidental. It just had to do with cheap rent primarily that they went there.
Right. You have to wonder what Henry Haight would think if he was looking ahead at what events would transpire on the street named for him.
There were so many different little twists and turns, and some of these folks, where they came from, you know, Grace Slick was out of a very strong banker family out of the East Coast. There was a Rothschild in that original group. So there were some fairly well-known family names. Augustus Owsley was the great grandson of one of the great Kentucky congressman who took on the likes of U.S. Tobacco and U.S. Steel. So these kids had some background, but some of it was a little bit far removed.
We're speaking with Michael Klassen about his book, Hippie Inc., the misunderstood subculture that changed the way we live and generated billions of dollars in the process. We have to make sure that we get down to some specifics here. You talk about the original 20 shops that were such a dramatic catalyst and kind of the heart and soul of all of this, and a couple hundred different products that actually emerge out of this original hippie movement. Probably none is more significant in terms of a single person and what he helped to generate than a gentleman whose name is utterly unknown to just about everybody, certainly to me, not if we read your book. Fred Rohe is his name, and he is really, in at least some respects, sort of the father of what we might think of as the natural organic food movement. Tell us who he was and how he came to be the creator of one of the most significant industries before the public today.
In fact, Greg, it was probably the most successful hippie business. I estimated at around $300 billion. Fred was hugely entrepreneurial. He was a kid out of New York, upstate New York, and he grew up in White Plains, New York. He was a rebellious kid in the 50s. He was a vegetarian, of all things. When everybody else was eating hamburgers and French fries, Fred was munching on carrots. He was just kind of a counterintuitive or counter-argument kind of a person. And so he quit, or left rather, New York as quickly as he could, because he'd heard about something called the Beat Movement. Unfortunately, by the time he got there, it was starting to kind of peter out. I think he got there in 58. So he got there in 58, began to get a feel for the neighborhood, and had himself employed at a health food store. We still see these stores around. These are stores of vitamins. A GNC store would be a good example of that. And he really liked it, except that he didn't like the fact that he could not get fresh organic food. And here he was in San Francisco. Why couldn't he get that in California? So what he was able to do was put together enough money. He bought out an old supermarket. I think it was run down. And he went in and he made the kind of store he wanted it to be. He pulled out the meat department and stuck in, instead of a meat deli, he put in a vegetable deli. And so this was happening in 1965, 66, very early on. Essentially what Fred did was set the template for markets, or for businesses like Trader Joe's and Whole Food Markets. And then he went on to create the first natural organic supermarket, the first natural organic cafe, distribution center, which is mammoth, and then also trade union, about $300 billion. When you contrast that to the music industry, which of course has gotten the most profile, it absolutely overshadows it. I always say the music industry was kind of a middling industry. Jerry made a lot of money, but he didn't make that much money. I had an opportunity, just a wonderful interview with Fred. He is not well. I believe he's about 85 now. His wife helped put together the interview, and just an amazing man. But here again, it's like you say, who knows who Fred Rogge is? Almost nobody, unless they're in that organic food market. I remember asking one of my first interviewees, who did this? And he said it was a guy named Fred Rogge. And he said, I used to go into Fred's store, and he would be sitting in the yoga position in the produce section chanting ohms. You know, so this was a guy who fulfilled, I guess you'd say, the stereotype. At the same time, he was incredibly inventive. And that's what I found time and time again, that the idea of the hippie slacker was just so badly wrong. Most of these people were very bright and highly ambitious, and certainly Fred was one of them. Fred went on to write several books on running, so on top of everything else that he did, he did some other things.
As sort of part of that facet of human endeavor, one of the things we can probably trace back to this period of time are a lot of the teas that now we completely take for granted. I mean, but once upon a time, it was just plain old Lipton tea and nothing nearly so interesting or exotic as what one easily finds today. And among the people you talk about is the person responsible for a company still flourishing, but now in Boulder, Colorado, namely Celestial Seasonings. Tell us a little bit about Mo Siegel.
Mo Siegel was a Colorado hippie. So, you know, I don't talk a great deal about non-San Francisco people because I just needed to keep it restrained. But he's worth mentioning because in the very earliest documents, 66, 67, I came across testimony and material that said that the hippies, you know, in that very early group were collecting leaves. They were brewing their own tea. They were adding different flavors to those teas. And again, we're in California. So we have, 12-month fresh fruits and other things on offering for, you know, at all times. So they were already beginning to take an old product, you know, how old is tea, and they were be able to start to make the tea a different way and then also to reconstruct it in terms of flavoring, sweeteners. They got rid of the white sugar. That had to go first of all because of what that represented. And bringing in more raw or honey or other types of sweeteners. And so it was beginning in the hate. Now, what Mo did in Colorado a few years later, obviously he was seeing this, is he went out in Boulder area and he began to find plants, natural plants in the mountains, and he would bring those back into Boulder and make teas with them. And then some of the really nice restaurants in town said, wow, this is a really great new taste sensation. Let's work with him. And, of course, he was the originator of Celestial Seasonings and Celestial Tea Market, which today I think is owned by Kraft or Hain Food Group. And, what they did was quite remarkable. Think today, Greg, I mean, you walk down the street. I'm here in Santa Barbara today. You know, I'm watching a person right now walking in front of me with a bottle of Peace Tea, you know. And so what they've got is what we call RTD, ready-to-drink teas. This is a billion-dollar business right now. It has its origins in the Haight-Ashbury district. And, of course, Mo Siegel took it to other levels.
Another amazing innovation that we can trace very specifically to this movement and this neighborhood and this moment in time is the notion of unisex jewelry and unisex bags. That is, before this, jewelry was something that mostly women wore. And if a man wore any jewelry, it might be a ring, it might be a watch. But the notion that you could create all kinds of jewelry that either a man or a woman might wear, or bags that either a man or a woman might carry, that was revolutionary. Tell us who was behind this this breakthrough, at least primarily.
It's interesting you should ask, because I was just speaking with him yesterday in San Francisco. The gentleman's name is Svi Strauss, and he was my very first interviewee in San Francisco, along with his wife, Hyla Davidovich Strauss. And if that Davidovich rings familiar to some people, she was, in fact, the great grandniece of Leon Trotsky, the great Russian revolutionary, whose real name was Lev Davidovich. But anyway, that aside, Hyla and Svi were really very inventive. Svi was a Harvard graduate and a Berkeley graduate. And they began to, they opened a shop up shortly after Jay and Ron opened up their shop on the Upper Haight Street. And they wanted to basically bring in native goods. That was kind of their start. And they made a trip to Mexico, and there they saw the use of bags by men for the first, well, not the first time, but one, you know, kind of critically. And so what they did is they began to buy up those bags and also make them in San Francisco and sell them out of their little shop on Haight Street. So Svi basically saw the potential there for bags being used by men and also jewelry. They saw men using jewelry, turquoise, and other kind of things. And they went ahead and then began to manufacture or whatever, put together these products in the store and then sell them out of the store. One of their most prominent customers was Janis Joplin. And I was in Svi's home just 2 days ago, and he said, let me show you a picture of Janis. And it was a well-known poster of Janis, and he said everything she's wearing came out of our shop.
Wow!
And she had feathers and beads, and Hyla, his wife, is often known as the inventor of love beads. So she said that Janis dressed in the manner that was exactly what our shop was trying to promote, and she was a very good friend of theirs, and she shopped there quite a bit. By the way, it's something else your audience might be interested to know. We often think of hippies as a kind of a style of dress. In fact, there were six different fashion styles that came out of that 2 year period. And one of them was the Janis Joplin style, which was the feathers and the beads and the and so forth. And again, that came primarily from C and Hyla's shop. Well, today, you know, the proof is in the pudding. They basically created in the bags and the jewelry for men about $11 billion industry. And you think today of the bags and the use of bags by men. He said in that day, he said a man would not carry a bag by its handle. He'd tuck it up under his arm. It was just too feminine to have this bag swinging from his hand. So those times have changed a little bit.
You also tell us the story of how tie-dye emerged. Yeah. Not that it was invented in Haight-Ashbury,
no.
but it emerged in sort of a different manner and in a sense for a different purpose. It's quite a wonderful story, actually.
I love this story, and I love meeting Judy Goldhoff. Unfortunately, Jody Palladini, who was her partner, has passed away. But Judy was, I believe she was a graduate of, but she had graduated from college, came to the Haight District. The movement was just beginning to get started. And she was a big believer in free products. She was a member of a hippie tribe at that time called the Diggers. And Judy, along with her friend Jody, decided that they wanted to create a product that homeless women on the street could make themselves and then sell to the retailers. They would make the contact with the retailers, one of whom was Svi Strauss and also his wife, Hyla Deer. And so she told me that basically there was a guy who came in one day with this huge pile of white shirts that nobody wanted. Nobody wanted to wear white shirts. They were essentially work shirts. And Jody, who had been familiar, was familiar with the Japanese technique called Shibori, said, why don't we try that technique? This is a 600-year-old technique, essentially what today we call tie-dye. And so they began to work with it, and they ultimately they started to hold workshops in the basement of a church on Waller Street. I've forgotten the name right now. And homeless women would come down there, and they would make their tie-dye shirts. And then Jody and Judy would kind of be brokers, if you will, to the retailers, and they'd start to sell them on the street. And that was the beginning of the tie-dye situation, fashion style. What's interesting is that Judy was very committed to social justice and movement. And, you know, had she, and she could have done this, had she bought the rights to that kind of a shirt, she would have been worth the multiple millions. She did not. She did not make a single dime. And you know what? She could care less. Hmm. So what you do have in the hate district are people who are very anti-capitalist, and we have people who are very pro-capitalist. It's an interesting story of the kind of cross-section of business techniques that were used. But yeah. It all started with just simply trying to extend a hand of help.
Hmm. And what is, of course, really important and maybe especially valuable about the stories that you tell is that they really emphatically disavow us of some of the assumptions that we tend to make about those early hippies, about them being, in a sense, lazy and just all about sitting around and thinking profound thoughts and but we don't think of them as industrious, as innovative, as practical, and in fact many of the people you're talking about were paragons of industriousness and pragmatism and so on. I mean, it just flies in the face of so many assumptions we make.
Well, in fact, one of my conclusions that I drew after, you know, 8 years of studying this was that the hippie movement was the most lucrative social movement in all of U.S. history. We've never seen that kind of productivity and innovation and invention come out of that. You know, it was about 40 innovative ideas and products I discovered that were hatched in that district that today, Greg, are worth nearly $1 trillion and employ millions of people here and abroad. So this is a story of entrepreneurship. And it's funny, I was just in a very nice bookshop here in Santa Barbara yesterday, and Hippie Inc. is on the shelf there. Where do they put it? Under entrepreneurship. In the business section.
There you
so,
go.
In a very kind of ironic way, again, the way we conceive of them, very different. They're very highly intelligent. It was really a magnet for some of the best and brightest and some of the most ambitious young people in America at the time.
Hmm. Well, we can learn much more about this moment in our history and these, well, really, you estimate roughly about 800 people or so who were really these original hippies.
Yeah, and their names are listed in the book. I'm sure we missed a few, and that was one of my biggest fears. But I think we pretty much got them. It was about 800 to 900 people in that original group, and they were the true believers. And they basically were there for about 2 years, and that was it. You know what's interesting about that, Greg, is that, you know, you look at some of the other movements, like the women's movement, for example, which came later. Some of the literature there says basically the same thing, that true believers were really active for the first 2 years, and then that was it. And you kind of wonder, and I'm not an expert on social movements, whether this isn't the kind of thing that happens a lot. In other words, you have the originals who really fight the fight, and then others take it on, and that certainly was the case here.
Hmm. The book, again, is Hippie Inc., the misunderstood subculture that changed the way we live and generated billions of dollars in the process, published by 6on7 Books and the author, Michael Klassen. Professor Klassen, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I've enjoyed this thoroughly.
Well, it's my pleasure completely, Greg. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be giving you a preview of this weekend's Secret Garden Walk in Kenosha, sponsored by Kenosha's Four Seasons Garden Club. It's an opportunity to catch a close-up glimpse of beautiful private gardens in